the story of Adam and Eve is a very old one, but it doesn't go back to first causes. It's not among the most ancient pieces of literature in our world. In fact, the entire story is an invention. Now, Eve was first created in the Genesis narrative. As the story goes, Eve ate an apple from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and the entire world suffered the introduction of sin. In the ancient Achaean version, later adopted by the Greeks, Pandora opened a forbidden jar. Later it was called a box, Pandora's box. And instantly all the evils and sorrows of the world escaped, and she shut the lid too late. Only one thing remained left in the jar. I'll let someone in the comments section below add that detail. But these narratives today seem silly, and many think purely mythological. But that is not the case. During the vapor canopy period, whole civilizations were thriving and at peace. They were ruled by the matriarchs. These were structured into a network of guilds, temples, groves, and a hierarchy that all served the goddess. The doom shape appeared in the sky, and there was earth shaking and floods, but the people lived on, unaware that on the other side of the world, across the vast deep, which we know of as the ocean, those civilizations were completely destroyed. So strangers arrived in warships, whole crews appeared, but they were all males, they were bearded, and they had advanced weaponry. These new arrivals to the old world could not be opposed. Their science seemed like sorcery. The matriarchs, they were forced to trade the daughters of men for secrets, for science and peace. The children of these strangers and the daughters of the matriarchy were unlike the males and females of their own blood, and many grew to great height, strength, and prestige. Basically, a whole new race was created from two separately distinct genomes. In a short time, the newcomers, aided with the numbers of their offspring, overtook the sanctuaries of the goddess and established their garrisons, established trade unions and military orders. They founded upon the principles of patriarchy that they brought from overseas. During the height of Babylon, this is like 700-800 years later, the patriarchy had all but vanquished the power of the goddess in politics and religion, though far out in the wooded groves, she was still venerated. Her sibyls and oracles were preserved. The Babylonians recorded events centuries after the collapse of the vapor canopy, known then as the Great Flood. The Jews, later in the great libraries of Babylon, they didn't understand these annals and invented the Adam and Eve story, blaming Eve for the sorrows of the world. They didn't understand that what they were reading in the Babylonian narratives was about the early race under the matriarchy called Adamu. And another group of people called the Kavites, which translates to as Adam and Eve. Now, the blame was entirely political and carried over into many mythological systems where females take the fall for introducing the ills into society. Pandora is a continuation of the patriarchy's war against the older goddess faiths. The strangers who appeared and changed history were the Anunna, and these were those few fleets that escaped the total destruction of North and Central America. This is the real history of the Anunnaki. This is what people need to be looking into, rather than the Zechariah Sitchin version-based fallacies that so many people have fallen for. I have over 230 videos, and I go into a lot of depth, and I cite my sources as to where this information is coming from. It has to be pieced together. There is no one ancient record that tells the whole story. This is the business of the historian. And many people become jaded in this time because they're finding that their own beliefs, the things that they have held to be true, are false. So instead of embracing the correct information, which I bring to the table over and over in my videos, people fall into despair and they go to the opposite extreme. It's like mentally they're polarized. And I get it. I'm not offended by this. But I read in the comments section all the time where people come across this wall, cognitive dissonance instantly shoves them to the opposite end of the spectrum. Now that they have seen evidence that their own belief is untrue, they go to the opposite end of the spectrum and say, well, how do you know the truth? How do you know that you got all the right information? And I don't. I don't. But I do know this. Not one single date out of thousands of dates that I have taught about in all my published books, my hundreds of posts, and my 230 plus videos, I have never deviated from a single date in all these thousands of patterns that I have showed you in my research. I don't have to, because I found the structuring. It's there for anybody to see. But you can't take one of my videos and dissect it and think that you have disannulled anything that I have found, because what I am revealing the actual structuring of reality through a series of videos. You have to take it as the whole. You can't take it piecemeal. It doesn't work that way. The subject matter is far too complex and all-encompassing to be dissected in pieces. If that's what makes you comfortable, then go ahead and do it. These videos are not for you, especially my published books. Now, when it comes to the histories of the patriarchal war against the matriarchy, this is what the Anunnaki arrival. Well, I say Anunnaki, but I'm only doing that because this is the frame of reference by which 90% of my viewers understand history. It's actually Anunna, or the children of Anu, or the children of An. Anunnaki came much later. As a matter of fact, the term Anunnaki never entered the historical record in any ancient clay cuneiform tablets until centuries after the Anunna were gone. And that is a problem. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed this video. I have many, many, many videos that discuss this, the Anunnaki and the Anunna files. There's not a lot of information we can glean about the matriarchy, because the erasing of their history has been so complete, and we see it only in fragments. And these fragments were put together, and it's the best that we can do under the circumstances. For over 25 centuries, a single old Bronze Age institution survived and has been practiced thousands of times in the courts of Europe, Asia, the Mediterranean, Africa, and has completely been misinterpreted. In the beginning of a king's reign, a young prince, king, dictator, whoever wanted to establish authority over a people, what the chief ceremony he would perform is the ceremonial slaying of a lion with a bow and arrow, a spear, an axe, a sword, or whatever his weapon of preference is, before a crowd of people. He would establish his dominion by slaying a lion. This ceremony has deeper roots. It has nothing to do with establishing dominance over a people or showing any type of regnal prowess. It has a symbolic meaning that goes back to ancient times, to a world that we have all but forgotten. There has never been a genuine academic explanation for Gilgamesh images of him subduing a full adult lion, so popular in ancient world, because the true history of that period has been censored. The victors edited the vanquished from the most of the records. Throughout the community centers, temples, and courts of the old Bronze Age were placed political statues of a mighty one breaking the power of lions, which was intended as a symbol of dominance. Do not be offended at the facts. There is no intent to injure here. The societies of the educated world before the cataclysm of 2239 BC in the early old Bronze Age were completely matriarchal, lunar-associated religions that depicted their matriarchs and goddesses with the symbols of their authority. Lions. Feline, moon-eyed, powerful, and majestic creatures. The most prominent artifacts from the ancient time are the mother goddess figurines between two lions. It was during the matriarchy that the sun was unknown. The vault of the sky was covered in clouds like the atmosphere of Venus, a vapor canopy, a dense mesosphere of moisture that diffused light across the entire sky without showing a solar orb. At night, a dew watered the entire world, and this marine sky magnified the moon into a gigantic planet ruling the night sky, enormous glowing object. The lunar cults of the goddess also esteemed the stars and established complex lunar calendars based off of the a magnified stellosphere. Our skies were so different back then. Many traditions attest to this fact, that the vault of the heavens was a violet. It was a cloud. It was cloudy. There were no individual clouds. It was a haze. The sun was never seen. It was just an ambient light. During this time period, things also grew to astonishing sizes. Then strangers with a very strange colored skin, alabaster, white, unusual apparel, great powers and technology like magic, appeared suddenly in fleets of ships. Their invasion was virtually unopposed. They had hair hanging from their faces. The smooth-skinned, black-eyed, and dark-haired peoples under the matriarchy quickly found they had no power to stop so mighty a foe that wielded weapons that they had never seen before. The goddess religions were challenged and controversy raged for over a century until the cataclysm. The phoenix tore apart the sky like a great red dragon. The mesosphere collapsed and the water from above rained on the world, mixed with reddish mud that buried whole civilizations in days, until excavations begun in the 19th and 20th centuries, where these ancient cities have been found and photographed for the modern world to see. Suddenly, the moon looked very small at night after this cataclysm, and the stars were only pinpoints of light, no longer the marvelous necklace of the heavens that had been magnified before by having an aquatic firmament. Now, in the daytime, the burning disk appeared. The sun was born. This was the ancient water sun age, the fiery disk unknown before, and its appearance at the same time the moon lost her size and power was more proof to the people of the fall of the goddess. So strong was the goddess revered in ancient Egypt that the invading Sumerians that founded Egypt's first five dynasties had to include her in their triad under Ptah. But they added elements that she was vengeful, bloodthirsty, a goddess of war. Her negative aspects were actually referred to her followers, who failed in their attempts to push back the patriarchy. The winged disc became the symbol of the patriarchy, of their power derived from the sun, of male gods that reigned superior over the goddess. This winged disc was never the symbol of Nibiru, as so many people attest, as Zechariah Sitchin has so falsely published. This dynastic patriarchal solar symbol was popularized at the same time that the hero between two lions was highly regarded. Everywhere where the patriarchy subdued the goddess followers, they erected heroes subduing lions. The revelation record stolen from the female prophetesses called the Sibyls is a return of the goddess power in the last days. The eschatology is clear. In the end times, a return of the widespread female authority will return just prior to a worldwide infrastructure destroying cataclysm. This is the subject matter of Archaic's research, that we are very close now to these two back-to-back epic disasters that the ancient world knew would happen in our calendar years of 2040 and 2046. There are people alive today who were alive 50 years ago, and at that time, 5 decades ago, they would have never believed that women would have the status, education, the authority that they have, the influence they have today in the corporate world. Fortune 500 companies, CEOs, attorneys, judges, the judicial system is absolutely packed with women now. Feminism, the suffrage, these movements, these concepts, They were alien to the world a century ago. But in the last 20, 25 years, women have been assuming roles of power unprecedented in the last 4,000 years. But there was a time long ago when it was the norm. As rapidly as our world is changing, it is going straight toward the old paradigms. We are not just entering, we have been in a period of time known to many seers, prophets, sages, and writers of old. These are the last days. And for many reasons, as posted throughout my archaic videos and posts, the last days actually began a timeline that began in 1902. But we are far into that timeline. In fact, the cataclysm of the ancient world will be revisited in our world. And many of you watching this video will be alive in 19.9 years when the next cataclysm occurs and when the fall of the matriarchy will happen again. It's going to be a brutal world on May 17th, 2040. And the powers that be are going to mostly be male. Gangland dictatorships, complete infrastructure collapse. It's going to be violent. People will no longer be valued for anything more than chattel, money, resources, slavery. We have some dark times coming. It's 20 years from now, almost. But what happened in the past is going to happen again. We're stuck in a loop, a series of simulated resets, and we have the exact dates for when they happened in the past, or at least Archaix does. This is Archaix.com with a special report about the matriarchy. Yes, guys, don't turn off my video and get ticked because of what you hear. But for a long time now, the establishment has pretty much put out the information that patriarchy has been the norm throughout antiquity. It's far from the truth. In fact, all of you who are adherents to the Anunnaki thesis would do well to understand why Anunnaki history fundamentally changed the architecture of civilizations. Long before the patriarchy, the goddess was venerated worldwide, and there were no male gods. The world was a very different place then. That's what this video is about. She took her authority from the water. And this is why the later Anunnaki records have the Anunnaki appearing out of the water, turning them into half-fish gods. They desperately attempted to borrow from the authorities of the older matriarchy to pull those worshippers in. This is Archaix.com. We look deeper than most people, and we find things others ignore. Our story begins in the 4th millennium BC. Yes, there are older human civilizations. No, we have no written records as to the who or the why of them. But this narrative, our modern world, actual history begins with the advent of recorded writings. Now, granted, most of the writings that we have from antiquity do not date before the 22nd century BC. However, many of those records claim they have what are called colophons. And in those colophons are statements. They are addendums to an ancient cuneiform tablet that affirm that it is merely the copy of an older tablet. Remember that. It's called a colophon. And they're dictating histories that happened 7-8 centuries earlier. Well, this story begins in the 4th millennium BC before we had pictograms, we had logograms, before we had anything that later developed into the writing systems of the old Bronze Age, which later developed into the Linear B, which into the alphabets that we have today through the Phoenician channels, which in the Greek channels, and then later into the runic and the huge amalgamation of written texts and languages that have widely developed all over Europe and Africa. Until today. But in the 4th millennium BC, we have a world that was fundamentally different than the world that we have been told existed. We have a world that is described in the oldest traditions in the world. There was no sun. We had a violet sky. No moon had been seen. There were only stars. Stars were held in great veneration. and the only authority in the entire world, among every race in this world, was the goddess, and she took many forms. But in every instance, the goddess took her authority, her power, and her dominion all came from the sea, from the ocean. Many of the apocalyptic records that were passed on through the Sibylline prophecies and later the Greek prophecies, you have to understand there is a difference. There is a distinction. The Greeks had their own prophetic texts. They had their own Pythian oracles and all that. However, the Sibyls, the prophets, prophetesses called the Sibyls, were a branch different. They were actually foreigners. They were not originally Dorian or Achaean. They were not Greek. They were Ionian. They were descendants of the ancient Canaanites, one of the particular branch of Amorites called the Israelites. But that's the subject for another video. But these prophetic passages that have been preserved in so many different texts and later up ended up in our Bibles, in the New Testament, in the book of Revelation, which was never a Christian document, ever. It is a collection of Gnostic prophecies that were taken straight from the Library of Alexandria, probably from 10 to 20 different sources, and put together into a linear narrative from many older apocalyptic records preserved by the Carthaginians and the Phoenicians. But that too is the subject of another video. These prophetic texts, they all have the same motives. They all have the same pretty much divine plan. And that plan was that the end will always mirror the beginning. And what we have in the book of Revelation is the reemergence of the authority of the goddess, the return of the matriarchy. Like I said, guys, don't get ticked. Turn my video off. You're going to make me mad. But I'm telling you now, the Christian world, the pastors and preachers and reverends and commentary writers and all these people who actually think that they know what they're talking about when they interpret the book of Revelation totally ignore the passages about the goddess and the seven-headed Hydra, the great dragon of the sea that gave her power. The world before the flood was nothing like the world afterward. Totally different. In the antediluvian period, there were people of short stature, black-eyed, black raven, dark straight hair, olive skin, 5 foot tall was about their average height. And this same people was found in the Urubamba Valley of South America, in Peru, Bolivia, the whole area, all the way to Easter Island. They were also found in the Yangtze Valley River in China. The same people were found in the Egyptian, ancient Greece, called them the Melampides. They were absolutely unsophisticated, insect-eating fishermen. That's all they were. No civilization whatsoever. These three river valleys mirrored the Indus Valley people and the Tigris-Euphrates, called the Ubaid people, and their descendants, the Sumerians, who prided themselves, calling themselves the black-headed people. Before this great cataclysm that destroyed the old Bronze Age civilizations in both hemispheres, and it doesn't matter if you're a flat earther or if you believe in the globe, it's irrelevant. What is relevant is that over 23 different ancient sources all date this 22nd millennium BC cataclysm. And in 1998, a whole consortium of specialists from different fields also came to the same conclusion. Geologists and paleobotanists and all these different scientists and archaeologists. In the year 1998, this was published in two of my books, many scientists from around the world came up with the conclusion that something totally devastating happened about 2200 BC. That knocked every single human settlement and civilization on this planet on their ass and totally depopulated them, reset them back to living in caves and just barely surviving. This event is recorded in the Bible as the Great Flood. Flavius Josephus, 2,000 years ago, wrote that it happened exactly 292 years before the birth of Abram. We know Abram is Brahma and Saraswati in India, but in the Genesis text, they are Abram and Sarah, or Sarai, after she came back from Egypt and was renamed. We have seen in my other posts that Abram visited the court of Pharaoh when the Great Pyramid was found in the desert sands after an earthquake in 1899 BC. We have also seen in other posts, I have shown much evidence that Abram interpreted the writings on the Great Pyramid because he knew. He was a very educated man. He was not just a shepherd, as Genesis. Genesis pretty much paints him as just a rich, wealthy shepherd, the son of a military general named Terah of Babylon. But it was far from the case. He was a very educated man. Aside from that, during the life of Abram, we have the patriarchy well established after the cataclysm. The gods are all male. All the dominant gods are male. All the heroes are male. And we have a whole new social demographic with the Sumerians, the black-headed people, now describing in text after text after text the arrival of very tall, pale-skinned, blue-sky-eyed and emerald-eyed people that had a feature that no one had ever seen before. And that feature is a beard. And suddenly, beards became the new symbol of dynastic power. Egyptian pharaohs for almost 1,000 years wore wooden beards because they couldn't grow facial hair. Wooden beards and stylized beards have been found in every civilization after the 21st century BC among people who could not grow facial hair. This has confused many historians and archaeologists into believing Caucasians were in their countries when they were not. They had long departed. But I digress. Before this cataclysm, men did not have authority. We were not property. But our own status was entirely dependent on the prestige of the woman that we served. Men were not married. Men were held for different reasons. Some were good slaves. Some were good workers and laborers that were not considered slaves, like tradesmen and men of the craft. Others were used as scribes, and many were personally selected purely for sexual prowess. Much of our histories have been sanitized because our scholastic organizations have been predominantly Christian, or at least maintaining a facade of Christianity for the past 400 or 500 years. The problem we've had with this is the absolute censorship of what archaeologists have been finding all over the world. We will take Pompeii and Herculaneum as an example. There were shops at Mount Vesuvius when Vesuvius blew up and buried hundreds of millions of tons of pumice and ash, buried people alive while they were still holding hands. Dogs were on leashes. Everything you see in a New York City suburb today is what you saw in the streets of Pompeii. Archaeologists, body after body after body, people doing different things in the park. Buried alive, entombed, fossilized in pumice. Sex shops with every sex toy you can imagine that does everything that you can imagine were available 2,000 years ago in the city of Herculaneum and the city of Pompeii. But 2,000 years ago, our level of sophistication wasn't near as high as it was during the matriarchy. When they moved 200-ton blocks 20 feet through the air to place them on 100-ton blocks at Baalbek in Lebanon, the architecture that has survived from the pre-cataclysm world is technolithic, which is a term that was coined by James O'Conn. Technolithic means that it is sophisticated to the point that would require some type of machining. And they are. We find ruins everywhere. I have books in my library right here. These are books I'm studying. I really don't want to move the camera, but I have a whole library full of books on all kinds of technolithic material. And I don't even really know what all books I have. Here's Charles Hapgood, Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that. I'm still studying that book. Columbus didn't discover America. Phoenicians and Carthaginians had maps of North America long before. King Magnus of Norway, 1362 AD, sent expeditions of Vikings across North America. Yeah, well, lost ancient technology of Peru and Bolivia. Yeah, you can flip through this and see evidence of technolithic architecture all over South America. We're talking about machine use in the creation of megalithic architecture that is so geometrically precise that we could not plane it today without a laser lathe. It's pretty interesting. Really informative, full of hundreds of pictures. I recommend this book, but then again, I'm not going to get into all that because I have thousands of books. And I don't even know if I'll even have time to read them all. I've already read and data mined 1,347 nonfiction reference books. These are the books I'm working on now. But I got to be careful. Like my buddy, Alan Alford, wrote The Phoenix Solution. Absolutely, absolutely brilliant book. Died a very mysterious death. Just like William Cooper, who published Behold a Pale Horse. Died a very mysterious death after his wife and son did. So I'm going to go off into all these little details like this and talk about all these books. What I'm going to do is tell you that before this cataclysm, women were the authority in society. Women made the decisions. They were the judges. They were the police. Women ran the courts. They ran the judiciaries. Oh, yes. They had very complex governments in the world before the cataclysm. In fact, we deduce this from the later Sumerian writings that preserve fragments of the world before. So many people are fascinated with the Anunnaki, not even realizing the Anunnaki were Caucasians who entered upon a world that knew no war. The cities of the Indus Valley and Harappan civilization, the original cities, saw no conflict. There was no shortages of food. Barbarity did not exist. There were no Colosseum, no blood sports. It seems that every civilization before the cataclysm was basically based in pleasure. Yes, sex. Sex sells. But the worship of the goddess did not involve what it has become in certain genres of culture today. The worship of the goddess then was pure. Yes, there was some pretty weird stuff going on back then. Men were feminized. Not all men, only some men. Maybe volunteers, I don't know. But they weren't brutalized, and they weren't tortured, and they weren't enslaved like some of the ultra-feminist goddess worshippers today. But it is true that the intellectual elite, the historians, those who preserve culture, the decision makers, the politicians, the queens, the regents, the rulers, they were all female before the cataclysm. And then something happened. No one knows where they came from. But a Caucasian race, mighty in war, with technology that rivaled that of the goddess-worshipping cultures, suddenly appeared in ships from the sea. When they appeared, they established dominion immediately, began rewriting the texts, rewriting the histories. They smashed the matriarchy. They enslaved the females. Within a few centuries, there wasn't a hint of the matriarchy left. After the cataclysm, the religionists among these orders of Caucasians called the Anunnaki, earlier called the Anuna, they rewrote the histories from before the flood, and they demonized the goddess, and they turned her into a beast and a seven-headed dragon, and they turned her into all kinds of Kali, the eight-armed dragon and spider grandmother of the ancient Navajo, and the Anasazi spider woman. They turned her into something that she originally wasn't. We have here a post-war propaganda so similar to what happened to the Germans after World War II that it's scary. History does repeat itself. But the goddess ruled the ancient world, and you need to take this into consideration when you read things like the Book of Revelation. Because when you read prophetic text through a Christianized filter, you're reading what Christians want you to think. And don't, I'm not disparaging Christians. I was one for the first 40 years of my life. Believe me, I was twice baptized, washed in the blood of the Lamb, Bible thumping, Muslim arguing against. I was all that. Son of the Most High God, filled with the Spirit. And then at 40 years old, my eyes were opened. Throughout history, it's the cultures that conquer are the ones that are allowed to write not only the history books, but even the books about the future. A case in point is the mysterious and enigmatic Book of Revelation. The Book of Revelation contains hundreds of symbols, imagery, that you can't find in the rest of the Bible except in one book, in the book of Genesis. The Omega text, the end, Revelation, seems to intertwine in its iconography with the beginning text, the Alpha text, Genesis. But with the second book of the Bible, the book of Exodus, all the way to the second to last book of the Bible, Jude, there's no correlates. It's like the beginning and the end are real and everything else in between is entirely fiction. But that's the subject for a whole other slew of videos. My point is that Christianity adopted far older texts and rewrote them into the garb of the Book of Revelation. The Sibylline oracles and much of the content of the ancient Greek and Roman prophecies became what is known as the Book of Revelation. The seven seals, the seven vials, the seven thunders. There's so many, there's the seven-headed dragon. There are so many things that we find in more ancient writings, but not in the Old Testament or in the New, just in Genesis and Revelation. The Sibylline oracles are mysterious, and of course many of them are lost, but through Tacitus and Tatian and so many other ancient Roman writers mention them and tell us about the books of the prophecies of the Sibyl. We have some of them today. We also have the Book of Revelation, which tells us quite a bit, and the mysteries that are attached to Cerinthius, who is attributed to have provided much of that material, not John the Apostle, which was later Christian cover story. Enjoy this presentation. This is about the legacy of the Sibyl that was passed on to Rome and how Rome preserved it to what we have today as the Book of Revelation. The court of Tarquinius, the seventh king of Rome, was frenzied with activity. The news had spread like a plague of the tradeways from Cumae. Knights, men-at-arms, acolytes, servants, mercenaries, foreign dignitaries, all together in a train, a huge escort ensuring the safe passage of the Sibyl. The prophetess brought old books to Rome. The visit was 515 B.C. Very ancient prophetic traditions from the era of the goddess were preserved among the temples of Ionia, the Aegean, and Ilium of Trojan fame. The Hellespontine Sibyl preserved many in the temple of Gerges, as did the Erythrae, the Erythraean Sibyl. The Cumaean Sibyl visited Tarquin the Proud in Rome. Among her writings were very ancient fragments from the Delphic and the Pythian oracles. A host of silent observers gathered to see the Sibyl, They gazed upon her austere servants, each holding three ancient books reverently. Hundreds of pairs of eyes stared at the wondrous tomes, full of the secrets of the past and future. The Greek prophetess did not bow to the regent of Rome. Instead, slowly, she spoke in Latin. "I bring unto you something more important than the future," she whispered. As she spoke, a servant's torch kissed a brazen altar, and the flames danced up toward the dish. "What gift you have for the king?" asked a servant. A thin man descended from a once wealthy Etruscan family who had lost their estates to equestrian-class Latins. "I bring no gift." The court stilled. Only the fire filled the silence. The king stared hard at the sibyl as she continued. "In ancient days we sat the thrones. Our visions saw the coming of kings, the fall of the sky, cities buried. We hid the words of the mother. We have gathered the books of Ugari, of Ionia, the Minya, Makan, and Shekelish, the secret sibyls. We have seen our fall, the darkness in Ilium, barren fig trees in Cumae." The court listened, understanding that the seeress was revealing the fall of the sibyls. But she stood majestic as she continued. "You shall pay 10 talents of silver, 1 talent gold, and 1 bolt of fine cotton from Gopta in the 9 bows, king of the 7 hills, she whispered as the eyes of the steward widened. "The price for the sibyl's books." Tarkin leaned forward, fist clearly betraying the mold of his mind. He spoke. "I'll pay nothing." The court hissed when the pale, tattooed arms of the sibyl grabbed the 3 holy books in the first servant's hands and tossed them into the fire. They crackled and burned quickly to the shock of the congregation. The servant collapsed to a knee, crying. "You witch!" The king of Rome stood gazing into the flames. 1,000 years of prophecies and secrets, codes and hopes cast into the fire. He sat down slowly as her words sliced quietly over the crackle of the flames. "You shall pay 10 talents of silver, 1 talent gold, and 1 bolt of fine cotton from Gopta in the 9 bows, king of the 7 hills, the price for the sibyl's books." The king said nothing. The steward opened his mouth, but Tarkin silenced him, right hand raised, staring angrily at the sibyl. She waited only for the space of a breath. The second servant whimpered when the seeress snatched 3 books out of her grasp and thrust them into the cauldron. The fire hissed like a devouring serpent as the people in the court raised their voices in awe, in disbelief and protest. A twitch of fear passed over Tarkin's face. The third servant girl stepped backward in terror of the sibyl, but backed into 2 large sapphic knights, protectors of the sibyl. The prophetess of Cumae took her books and turned to glare defiantly at Rome's regent. "You shall pay 10 talents of silver, 1 talent gold, and 1 bolt of fine cotton from Gopta in the 9 bows, king of the 7 hills, the price for the sibyl's books." Several shouts from the court. A woman in the crowd begged the king to pay. Another voice cried out that he would pay 3 ships of sponges from Sardinia and 20 ingots of iron for the remaining books. Someone else yelled they would give her a vineyard estate for the remaining works. Tarkin said nothing, and the sibyl did not hesitate. She cast 3 more books into the fire as the third servant girl fainted. Several moans, cries of surprise. An old woman in the back of the court wept loudly, body racked with shudders. The king stood and descended 3 steps. The sapphic knight stepped forward. The Capitoline guards raised their shields and worried, knowing of the fearless valor of the oath-sealed warriors of the goddess that had attained knighthood. The sibyl said nothing as she gently took the 10th and final book, the largest, from the hands of a 4th servant girl. Her head bowed, tears on her cheeks. The sibyl walked up the steps toward the king and thrust the book into Tarkin's hands. When she whispered, he was the only one who could hear her. "You shall pay 10 talents of silver, 1 talent gold, and 1 bolt of fine cotton from Gopta in the 9 bows, king of the 7 hills. The price for the sibyl's books." Tarkinius was forever known as the Proud, Tarkin the Proud. He paid the sibyl. The last book of the Sibylline Oracles was treasured by Rome, copied, preserved, and consulted by the Roman Senate. Libraries throughout the later Republic and then the Empire were filled with passages from the Sibylline books. The Sibyl walked away knowing that nothing had been lost, for the fourth girl held in her grasp the whole of what the nine were but parts. The ancient Greek prophecies were adopted into the writings of the Roman Church. In this way, we have much prophetic material preserved, even today, in the form of a prophetic text you know popularly as the Book of Revelation. The church never stamped out the goddess. It adopted her. Cal, the powers that be were pleased. The public had been deceived yet again. The long count is an apocalypse calendar, but its end in 2012 was a deliberate deception. In 2011, my book, Anunnaki Homeworld, was published by Book Tree of San Diego, the year before 2012. All the craze was about speculating what was going to occur in 2012 at the end of the Mayan long count calendar. What happened to all those authors? In Anunnaki Homeworld, I made it abundantly clear with charts, detailed proof showing that 2012 was not the end of the long count. An entire chapter packed with data revealing that the end of the long count isn't until November 2046. I'm not the first to know this either. Whoever built the Great Pyramid of Giza knew it as well. The bewildering Mayan long count calendar is not so mysterious once compared with the Annus Mundi system, or Year of the World chronology, so popular in ancient Alexandrian texts and afterward. Scholars have determined that this old American calendar has a start date of August 12, 3113 BC, a date that has baffled Mayan scholars. The Mayan calendar will end once 13 baktons are completed, and incredibly, these baktons are expansive units of time that are measured at precisely 144,000 days each. 13 epochs of 144,000 days. Thus, the entire Mayan system concludes at 1,872,000 days, which reads in the calendar 13.0.0.0.0. The fact that days were the prime unit of calendrical reckoning of the Maya is a common thread to the much earlier Sumerian civilization, a culture also counting their periods in days, as we've discussed in prior videos. Now, this 3113 BC extends back to the year 782 before the flood, or 782 Annus Mundi, which is only 13 years prior to the date the Sumerian scholars ascribe to Etana, the Enoch of the Sumerian king list. 11 years from the start of the Brahmanic Kali Yuga age, and again, 8 years from the beginning of the Mayan Itza Temple of the Cross calendar, which is a goddess calendar. Excuse me. The Mayan system, as well as the others noted here, began during the reign of the prophet King Enoch, the biblical figure merely a Hebraicized version of the Sumerian Enki. Its start date in conjunction with the building of the pyramids and reign of its principal architect, Enoch, and allusion to a time in the last days hints that this system was intended to start at a very significant date in the beginning that commemorated another time period that was going to be disclosed in the end. And as Lost Scriptures of Giza, my book clearly demonstrates, this was the chief purpose of the Great Pyramid, an apocalypse recorder and prophetic time capsule. Though antiquarians associate the Egyptian ruler Khufu with the Great Pyramid, they call him Cheops, the Greek version, the actual title is Maya Itza. It is a description of a sacred area, a Khufu. Though this is not to be addressed until later, the problem we have with modern scholarship is that the interpretation of this system's 13 baktons ending in 2012 is because chronologists today assume the Earth's 365.25 day orbital period, making the year has always remained constant, and this is far from the truth. Recalibrating the long count to 13 baktons of draconian days, 360 days each, gives us 5,200 years exactly. 52 being the sacred number of the Maya, the Aztecs, the Quechua, the Zapotecs, the Toltec, and provides us an incredible date important to our study later in these videos. The Maya considered the 365.25 day to be a vague year, and they did not factor it, and they would never have adopted the vague year for their historic and holy long count system. Even the greater sum of 144,000 days, a total back then, exhibits the use of the lower denominator of 360 because it's divisible by 360. It is not divisible by 365 or 365.25. But these facts and divisors do not only apply to the Mayan long count. The truly remarkable Brahmanic system is even closer in synchronicity to the Sumerian system than the ancient American one. The Kali Yuga age of India marks the beginning of mankind's degeneration into evil and has a start date of 3102 or 3103 BC. 11 years after the beginning of the long count. The Kali Yuga age was predicated on the idea that the age would come full circle after the end of a 6,000 year period. Note that the Kali Yuga was the fourth age of India and did not start with the beginning of Brahmanic reckoning. The proximity of these start dates is laden with implications. All four of these references, the Temple of the Cross, the Mayan Long Count, the Etana Record, and the Brahmanic Calendar, all fall within a 21-year period that we've shown in a prior video, perfectly averaging out at 800 years Annus Mundi. If we conclude that the Mayan Temple of the Cross calendar was designed to start contemporaneously with the Long Count instead of 7 years priorly, at one time they were obviously the same calendar. And this conclusion is not without further confirmation from the Maya themselves. The Maya Temple of the Cross calendar has been assigned a start date of 3121 BC, or 774 AM, Annus Mundi, and the Maya records claim this system began with the ascension of a goddess from the earth who is represented by a rather grotesque glyph. The inscriptions in the temple reads that Lady Beast with upturned snout was over 800 years old at the time of her ascension. The ascension of a deity is preserved in the Ascent of Enoch. However, an 800-year-old woman was not uncommon during those days prior to the flood, according to ancient sources, especially Genesis and even the Sumerian king list, which has rulers living for long periods of time. Not the Sitchin corrupted hundreds of thousands of years, but 120 years and 128 years and 140 years. But we've already covered those issues in prior videos. Before the deluge, the goddess was the chief object of worship as attested around the world among the earliest sites. It was after the flood that the patriarchal societies became dominant and turned goddesses into gods. The 800-year reference could refer to 800 Annus Mundi, or the 800 could be a numerical disguise for the eight kings, because the Lady Beast is no doubt equated with the Sumerian Babylonian dragon Tiamat, the seven-headed dragon that supports the eighth. In the biblical apocalyptic book of Revelation, she is called Mystery Babylon and the Harlot. Now, you have to understand, this equates to ancient hate speech. This is patriarchal priesthoods demonizing the older goddess cult. Now, are we to delegate this as mere coincidence? Are we to assume Mayan records in the Temple of the Cross any less accurate than the scientific calculations in the Mayan Dresden Codex that contain Venus almanacs so precise they ensure an accuracy of within 2 hours in 500 years of Venus calculations? Are we to be that hypocritical? We are reminded here of a most truthful statement made by Robert B. Stacy Judd in 1939 when he wrote that beneath the stories of world mythology, there is truth veiled in various disguises. And by careful comparison with somewhat analogous accounts from widely scattered areas, fundamental characteristics frequently show remarkable parallels. If, therefore, extraneous data disclose that a certain amount of fact underlies most myths and legends, let us, for the time being, consider them as a medium of information, subject to the more definite acceptance of substantiation through other sources. Keeping this in mind, we note that the Mayan and Brahmanic histories are fused together by the goddess motif, for the Kali Yuga was modeled after the Indian goddess of destruction, Kali. She had eight arms, matriarchal memory of the Scorpion King, and was a frenzied, bloody woman with weapons of war in each hand. Other Native American cultures, probably distantly related to the Maya, maintain traditions concerning Spider Woman, who was linked to the number eight, an arachnid having eight legs, and the creative power of weaving webs. In early Mexico, the spider was the surrogate of evil and cold, known as the arch-deceiver and enemy of mankind. The mother-goddess connection is prevalent everywhere in the early Americas, the genetrix of a malign race of stone giants. These giants sought to exterminate mankind before they were hurled over the great abyss.
The Aztecs tell of these giants during the reign of Tlaloc, the Mexican Enoch, a man who lived for 364 years until an evil goddess began to rule the world and the world was destroyed by a flood. This is a direct reference to Enoch, who lived 365 years before being translated into heaven to vanish. The 364 recalled simply because it aligns with the Mexican calendars, which are divisible by 52. 52 times 7 is 364. The goddess's name was Ischuna, and she is faulted for the great flood. She further being remembered as being representative by a constellation that had fallen from the sky. Very interesting, because we find the exact same reference in the old Jewish Haggadah records of a constellation vanishing from the sky before the flood. This primordial woman that caused the deluge is told of in Old Cornwall, Wales, and Brittany, as well as across the globe in early Persia. The Hopi too remembered a wicked goddess who had access to a ladder that reached the world's axis. Now remember, the world's axis mundi has always been a reference to the Great Pyramid Complex. These details are distinctly Euphratian in origin. Ishtar of the Babylonians and Inanna of Sumer were also identified with ladders that reached heaven and were both connected to flood myths involving divine necklaces with beads, blue beads, lapis lazuli, that represented the Anunnaki. Another title for Inanna was Aruru, and she had a necklace of lapis lazuli beads similar to the divine necklace of jewels worn by the Japanese goddess Amaterasu. This Japanese story tells that after the passage of seven generations, which would be during the eighth one, of gods appeared the Izanagi and the Izanami. These beings are no doubt a corruption of the Sumerian Anunnagi or Anunnaki, the Anuna. Now, Izanami is merely a Japanese female version of Izanagi. The goddess associated to the seven in Egypt was called Sefnet Abut, the goddess of the laying down of the foundation, of the repetitions of seven, the guardian of the cycles of 30 and 120 years, a Sumerian Shar, a great Shar. Over her head was a seven-rayed star, and about her neck was a rainbow scholars identify as the same symbol of Ishtar's collar of jewels. The seven-pointed star, as seen in my book, The Lost Scriptures of Giza, was important to the architectural mechanics of the Great Pyramid, for the seven-pointed star provides a perfect 52-degree angle, and 120 is the Sumerian Great Star in use when the pyramid complex was constructed upon the firm foundation in Egypt at Giza. Its 52-degree angle slope making it the most unique pyramid in the world. Even in late Greek antiquity, this mythos was still circulating. It was said that a god of forging made a wonderful necklace, and it was given to Harmonia, a goddess. Despite its divine origin, the necklace was to bring about the end of a later generation. We will soon revisit this goddess of the antediluvian world. The primordial genetrix, the goddess of all the antediluvian religions, who reappears in the last days' prophetic imagery of the revelation, which was copied from the older Sibylline oracles and Sibylline prophecies, the ancient Greek prophecies, and reappeared in our apocalypse, riding upon a seven-headed beast. She was the matriarch before those seven Anunnaki kings who claimed descent from her. Let us now explore who these regents were to the ancient world in the next video. Again, we will be visiting the antiquity of the goddess in future videos. But what must be understood here is, remember, I remind you constantly that we're looking at ancient history through the lens that they appropriated to us. We're not really looking at it in the vein that it happened. What I'm seeing here is that the Anunnaki patriarchal society totally robbed the matriarchal government of its prestige by claiming descent. Evidently, there was so much opposition to the coming of the Anuna and to their form and style of government, which is basically overthrowing the traditions and lifestyles of the matriarchy, that they had to claim descent from the great matriarch herself in order to establish the veracity of their dynasty. So what we are left here is that a political controversy, also a racial controversy, occurred before the flood. The Anuna, the Caucasian branches of the human race, took the political reins in government away from the matriarchy, who were not Caucasian, and they began to rule. But in order to get people to fall in line, they claimed descent from the goddess. Now, what we have is a transfer of power to the patriarchy, the Anunna, the Anunnaki. And this transfer of power basically lasted 4,500 years or so. However, there's going to be a complete reversal, or a semi-reversal, in the last days. And during the apocalypse, there will be a return of the goddess worship.